Factopia. Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi, udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Ugeavisen Ingeniøren, med støtte fra Innovation Center Danmark, Messecenter Herning og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia.
Tektopia.
Hvordan ser fremtiden egentlig ud, hvis man kigger i en krystalkugle? Ja, den er jo nok i virkeligheden bare en refleksion af det, der foregår inde i hovedet på en selv. Man ser måske kun den fremtid, man ønsker. Hvis man beskæftiger sig med teknologi og forretningsudvikling inden for teknologi, så er det måske ikke så heldigt igen. Det kan være en stor fordel at kunne se forskellige fremtider, forskellige mulige fremtider. Og det er netop det, Tektopia handler om i dag, hvor vi skal hilse på en futurist, som ikke bare er en futurist, men også er designer og teknologiudvikler, og hjælper virksomheder med at komme derfra, hvor de er i dag, til et sted ud i fremtiden med den teknologi, de skal bruge eller udvikle. Så det kommer til at handle om fordomsfri tænkning, både hvad angår mennesker og teknologi, når vi skal snakke om mulige fremtider. Velkommen til Tektopia.
I am Vanessa Julia Carpenter, and I have my own company called Kintsugi Design. And I have been here in Denmark for a while now, let's say, maybe 12 years. And in that time, I've been working with interactive art and technology, being an artist on Illutron. I've had my own company doing interactive art installations. I've worked with Delta and then Force Technology for 7 years, doing consumer-facing smart product development. And then I wrote my PhD in designing for meaningfulness in future smart products. And then I decided to start my own design company, focusing on how we can make future technologies which address meaningfulness.
When you say designing for meaningfulness in technology, what do I actually mean? What does the word meaningful mean to you when it comes to technology?
I like to frame it in three different ways. So I look at people to people, so our relationships between ourselves and others, a person to their sense of self, so my self-development, my identity, who am I, who do I want to be, who have I been in the past, who do I want to be in the future, and a person to a sense of time. So how do I represent time passing? How do I sense time passing? How do I mark time? And I look at meaningfulness in terms of the long term. So not the hedonic short term, you know, instant gratification, but rather the long term of how do we live a meaningful life? And I think that most technology today is based on convenience. You have a smart coffee cup that tells you when your coffee's cold, or you have a smart shoe that tells you how many steps you've taken. But few technologies are developed to help people with their self-development. And that's what I'm aiming to do.
But you mentioned time also as a perspective here. Mm-hmm. Most technology is designed to last for a very short period of time,
yeah,
isn't it?
It is. It is. And one of the things that I've been looking at is things like heirloom devices. Could we develop technologies that we pass on to our grandchildren, right? Maybe we use energy harvesting for that to get past the battery issue. But then it would be a matter of what is the purpose of that device and how does it fit into our lives and what we do? Does it make sense to us to keep that for many generations? Because right now we might buy a new wearable and we'll keep it for 6 months and then it'll go in a kitchen drawer.
Or it will break down.
Or it will break down.
Be yeah. replaced of some, by something newer and better.
Yeah.
So how will you do this?
That's a great question. So I am very interested in working in an interdisciplinary manner. So because I've been working in industry for so long, about 15 years now, then I take my industry knowledge and then I also look at my art background, right? And look at what artists are doing. You know, in industry, we always look at what are our competitors doing. I also like to look at what are artists doing, what are makers and hackers doing, and what's happening in between all of them so that we get this interdisciplinary view. And then because I wrote my PhD, I'm also looking to academia. So I'm like, what is happening in academia that we can actually bring into industry and use? Because even though that's the goal of many different collaborations, that doesn't always happen.
This thinking, is that the sort of the framework for Kintsugi?
Yes, absolutely.
What does kintsugi mean, actually?
Kintsugi is a traditional Japanese craft. So if you have a piece of broken ceramic, for example, like a plate or a bowl, then in Japan, there are craftspersons who are trained to mend these bowls or plates by taking precious metals and filling the seams to put the plate or bowl back together. And then the whole philosophy is that the plate or bowl or whatever it is far more beautiful and precious and unique than it ever was before in its previous life of just being like an IKEA bowl, for example.
Because it was repaired to last longer.
Yeah, and because now it has these marks where you can see where the breakage was, but it's been repaired lovingly and with care and with precious metals.
So it's like grown older with grace.
Yes, very much so. And so with kintsugi design, my ambition is to take so many different things that are broken and repair them with care and with attention and with precious dedication to emerging technologies and how we're going to live our lives as human beings and make a more robust future.
I was actually thinking when you talked about the life cycle of technology, how short it is. And you were mentioning now the kintsugi and what you're talking about, what you're actually aiming at. Could you compare it to sort of an old-fashioned craftsmanship?
Absolutely. So a lot of the work that I did in my research was looking at craftsmanship because with a traditional craftsperson, they learn their material, they learn this trade, they learn all these amazing things about the properties of the material and the tools and just how to hold them. And in our increasingly digital world, we're losing that motor function, right? We're losing that sense of touch and feel and how we relate to our bodies and ourselves and the objects around us. And I think that one of the aspects of designing new technologies is to very much consider how they play into our bodies as human beings.
Which is also about design, because if you go back in time and look at the role that the craftsman had in society, it was about designing objects specifically for certain people who ordered them, as I understand it.
Yeah, definitely. There was usually custom pieces, right, if we go way back. And then, of course, we had Industrial Revolution and we're able to make many of the same thing. But if we even look at, you know, here we are, we're situated in Denmark and we're right beside Vesterbro. There's a ton of independent shops that are popping up there that are making one-of-a-kind things that are going back to this craft, traditional craft approach to how we make things.
But could you actually apply this thinking to, like, for instance, my watch, which is a typical mass-produced object?
Yeah, absolutely. So one great example is there's a Bluetooth speaker called the Marley speaker, named after Bob Marley. And what they did was they used reclaimed fabrics and sustainable materials like bamboo. And they tried to use technologies that had a good conflict-free resource. So the technologies that they used inside, like the actual components, were coming from conflict-free zones, right? Not all of them, but I think some of them. I don't know the whole history of it.
Could you specify conflict-free zones?
Of course. So there's a lot of work being done in the world to verify where our electronics are coming from. So a lot of what's inside of your phone, for example, all these little bitty components, you know, the accelerometer and transistors and all the things that are inside of your phone, the raw materials for those are sourced from different places in the world, a lot of them in Africa. And in these places, a lot of them around the Congo area, those are sourced in ways where there's a lot of slavery happening in mines to source those resources. And then once those are sourced, then they're going through these huge conflict zones where there's wars going on over the money and the materials and everything else. So that means that the electronics that we use in a lot of our products are coming from these places which are funding slavery and war, right? So there's a lot of organizations and people out there who are trying to find conflict-free resources, who are trying to make sure that these places have good jobs for people where they're not in slavery, where the goods are transported in a way that doesn't supply weapons to war zones. So it's a huge area.
So it's a kind of a social sustainability, you could call it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or fair trade on electronics or?
It's a lot of those things. So it's both fair trade, but it's also, It's environmental, it's from a social perspective, it's a lot of different things that contribute to where our electronics come from. And as people who are working and developing new technologies, we often just look for, okay, is this technology compatible? You know, is it certifiable? Is it going to be okay to get on market? But we don't always look past that to see where did the origin of this come from? Where did the tin come from? Where did the gold come from? Right?
But actually, Kintsugi is doing something different because you're sort of what would you call it, a hired hand for companies to get into this field?
Yeah, so what we're doing is our sort of flagship service is called a designer in residence. We also have a design director in residence that's available. And basically what we're doing is we're going into companies for 3 months. And the whole idea with this is that, you know, like the first 3 months that you're at a job, you have all that excitement and, you know, you're sharing things with people over coffee and you're like, oh, have you seen this? Have you seen that? So the 3 months is the honeymoon, right? And we come in and we help companies look up, especially in these corona times, because a lot of companies are just treading water and trying to survive. We help them look up and look towards the future. And so we look at emerging technologies. We help them build some exploratory prototypes because, again, we're very interested in what we can touch and feel and see, right? Because it's one thing to say, okay, we could make this and, you know, draw some sort of model, but it's much more interesting if you can get your hands on something, right? So we build prototypes, we look at strategy, we look at emerging technologies, we create catalogs and reports of what they might be interested in. Like if they're interested in wearables, we might look at smart textiles, right?
What kind of companies do you aim at? Small companies, medium-sized companies, or?
It's predominantly medium and larger-sized companies. And it's interesting because I've spoken with a number of design companies who are interested in having an external perspective come in because they know the value of the beginner's mind, right? They know the value of taking someone external to bring it into their operations to get fresh eyes on what they're doing. So there's been a number of design companies that are interested in this. There's also been some companies who don't have design or electronics as a core resource. So for them, it's very interesting to have someone come in and say, this is where we could work. And we're very much not a traditional consultancy in the way that we come in and tell people what to do. We're rather partners for that time, helping to grow and pull out those ideas that are within the company and finding out what makes most sense for them.
When you first told me about this, I was thinking about this X-Lab idea that originated from Google, where they do these moonshots of technology in a sort of a secret lab, which is not at the core of the business, but somewhere on the edge. And if it works, they will move it into the core of the company. Is that what you're doing, or is it something different?
Yeah, we're definitely inspired by that. We've looked a lot to what Google has done. Like Project Loon is a great example of that, this internet via air balloon. And, you know, where it started as a just like you said, like a small idea, where they did a lot of rapid iterative prototyping, and then it became its own company, right? And we're very much inspired by that. We're inspired by this idea of going in and showing a few possible futures. And one of the things we're very interested in is deconstructing the set idea of a future that someone might have or that a company might have. So a lot of the times it's like, okay, we make these pens. I'm holding up this pen that I'm using here, these pens, and that's it. And we just have to, you know, make a new color of it or a new version of it. And then maybe what we'll do is we'll come in and say, okay, but have you thought about making, you know, colors coming out of the end of your fingers to write on, or something, you know, a little bit more crazy, or a different way of writing, or have you thought about changing how we take notes altogether? So it's, some might call it disruption. I'm a little hesitant to use that word.
Well, why are you hesitant about that?
Disruption has, it's such a buzzword, right? And people have this idea that you're going to come in and pivot and completely change history. And disruption doesn't necessarily have to be that way. Disruption can be subtle. Disruption can be new ways of thinking about things, like I said before, coming in with the beginner's mind. So I think it just has so much built into that term, and it's so overused that it's not the best term to use here. I would rather say exploring potential futures, exploring possible paths, and not just exploring them like saying, oh, hey, over there looks interesting, but actually building something and trying it out, right? Finding out what would it be like in that future. So by possible futures, I'm really interested in how people have ideas of what the future might be. So often, you know, if I ask you, what do you see the future being? What would be your answer?
Oh, it depends. I'm actually thinking we have a post-corona future, we have a five-year future, we have a 50-year future, and we have like an eternity.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so I love that answer, first of all, because you're thinking on different time horizons. Let's take a 50-year future. Then what do you see? What does the city look like?
I wouldn't know. I mean, it's like looking into a crystal ball. And if you look into a crystal ball, I mean, it's kind of dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you only see only your own reflection, so to speak.
For sure, for sure. And I mean, it's also a bit tricky asking you because you think about this stuff every day. I think most people that I ask, they would say, you know, oh, there's high rises, there's flying cars, there's robots, you know, this future that we expect from what we've seen in movies, right? And what I'm trying to help companies with is see a variety of possible futures, a diversity of futures, if you will, because there's so many different technologies out there. One of the things that I notice is I do a lot of workshops. And in these workshops, I'm helping people explore new hardware and new technologies. And quite often, I have this experience where someone's great idea is an iPad embedded in something. An iPad in a tree, an iPad in a door, an iPad somewhere. And it drives me crazy because I'm like, there's so many opportunities with technology. There's so many different sensors. We've come so far in the past 10 years in terms of what's possible. There's hundreds of sensors available and literally anything can be an actuator, right? So for me, I'm like, let's dive into those. Let's explore these emerging technologies. Let's find out what's in the world and what's possible. And then let's start thinking about your future as a company and what you're going to be making and contributing to the world.
But this sounds like it's, I mean, ignorance might be a wrong word, but it is some sort of ignorance when it comes to technology and the knowledge about technology.
I think it's just lack of knowledge, right? Because we are, what we're given as consumers, and granted, it's been changing in the past 3 years, right? But what we're given as consumers is screen-based devices. We're given black mirrors, right? We have phones, we have tablets, we have laptops. But we're not often seeing what else is possible. Now, we had to chat this morning because you have a smart ring, right? And that's something that I would also like to invest in because it has a whole bunch of different sensors in it. It gives me a lot of information about what's happening in my body, which is fascinating. And a lot of people don't know that that's out there. So I don't know that it's necessarily, well, maybe it is ignorance, but, you know, unwilling ignorance. They just don't know that it's possible yet. And when you work with technology, when you see that there's, you know, pH sensors and color sensors and humidity sensors and gas sensors and all sorts of different things that we can sense about the world around us, then it's quite fascinating to think about what we could create in terms of technology.
So what you're actually talking about is ambient technology?
To some degree. I mean, I think it's circumstantial. So in some cases, maybe we're looking at ambient technology, what's happening in our environment. In some cases, maybe we're looking at how our business functions in the future of technology, right? And in some cases, like we were speaking about before, it might be about meaningfulness. So how does this piece of technology enable you to explore meaningfulness in your life? I can give an example if that helps.
Example.
Example time. So my classic example, and maybe I've used it way too many times, and if you've heard it, please forgive me, but it's the pregnancy wearable that I was helping to develop. It was called Phoebo by a startup called First Bond Wearables. And basically the idea was that they built a wearable. They were jewelry designers by trade, again, going back to traditional craftspeople. And they built a wearable with three small metal balls inside of it. And the idea was that the pregnant mother would wear a patch on her belly. This is commercially available. And that would feel the kicks, the pushes, the hiccups, the rolling of the baby. And then by wearing this wearable, the partner could feel those movements. So not just the kicks, but also the hiccups and these little pushes and everything else in real time. And the whole concept behind this was that the partner could be involved earlier in the pregnancy than just when the baby arrives or when they feel that first kick, right? So it's very much about coming to terms with your identity. So who have I been? Who am I now as I'm becoming a parent? What kind of parent do I want to be? The stories that that enables, right? So maybe the partner would ask the mother, wow, what did you have for lunch today? The baby's been kicking all day long, right? So it's these small moments of personal development and shared relationship development over time. So if you remember people to people, people to self, people to time, that's the meaningfulness that emerges through the creation of this wearable device. So there we're using new technologies, moving parts in a wearable, right? And finding out how to connect it to a patch, you know, a fairly recent product that the mother wears, and exploring how that could create potential futures for mothers and for partners.
But when you introduce stuff like this to companies, how do they react? Do they get your vision, or do they understand it?
Yeah, I've done a lot of workshops with companies, and they've been fairly into it. They like the idea of it. They, of course, you know, like companies are very interested. Maybe I'm saying this too broadly, too generally, but companies are very interested in having their product be a success on market, right? And so if your product caters to a person's sense of identity, if it caters towards them developing as a human being, that's a success. That's something that the person is going to value in their life. They're going to pay more money for it. They're going to keep it for longer. It's going to matter more to them. So I think the short answer is yes.
When we talk about the way that people sort of think about the future, and it's mostly like flying cars, you say, and sci-fi stuff, is it wrong to think about the future in terms of like a sci-fi story like Blade Runner or something like that?
No, I think it's absolutely right, because sci-fi allows us to explore possible futures. And often sci-fi acts as a catalyst for the creation of possible futures. So I was thinking about it a little bit before we chatted today. And if you look at some examples, like we have this Metropolis movie, right? And that was back in, I think, 1927. And that was where the first video call was portrayed, right? And now look at us in 2020 doing all these video calls. And then you have things like Minority Report. That's where most people are familiar with touchscreens. But of course, in 2001, A Space Odyssey, and especially in Star Trek, there was tons of touchscreens. And I have to say, I'm a huge Trekkie. So I've watched all the Star Trek that there is. And maybe that's influenced how I look at technology, that anything is possible. And Star Trek was really, really good at doing sci-fi in that way, where a lot of the stuff that's been in Star Trek has become reality.
But isn't it sort of like narrowing our visions if we look too much at sci-fi, like it's been produced for like the past almost 100 years? Wouldn't it be better if we sort of set our minds free from sci-fi?
I would say yes and no. We should set our minds free from the constructs of what is expected, right? That everyone expects we're going to be in Minority Report or in The Matrix, right? From those Hollywood perceptions of sci-fi. But there's so many amazing sci-fi stories that are yet unexplored. There's a lot of sci-fi written by women, written by Black people, written by people of many different backgrounds that we have yet to explore. And I think those are really, really fascinating.
But another thing about sci-fi is mostly dystopian.
Mm-hmm.
How do you work with a dystopian sort of a future if you want to design for meaningfulness?
That's such a good question. So a lot of sci-fi is dystopian. There is some that is utopian. There is some that is somewhere in between. And I think, you know, it's up to us to also find those sci-fi stories, to bring them to the light and to start looking at things that are not just dystopic, right? And also, I came across this term that I wanted to bring up with you because I thought it was so much fun. Galactic suburbia. And that was Joanna Russ, who was a sci-fi author, and she talked about galactic suburbia. And apparently this was when sci-fi is really good at like imagining wild technological futures and interplanetary, you know, social relations, but that they still had a nuclear family with 2.5 children, right? And I just thought that was so fascinating because just like the dystopic futures, then you have this, okay, we're kind of exactly the same, but we have aliens and flying cars and whatever else. So for me, I'm really interested in pushing the boundaries, pushing the creative boundaries, pushing the imagination boundaries of what is possible and what our futures could be. And I think we can definitely do that if we look to meaningfulness.
Du lytter til Tektopia i Mors Næstnæsten og Lytter.
I was thinking, when you talk about technology in this way, where do you see design begin and end when it comes to technology? Or are both things sort of converging, in your opinion?
I think for me, they're intertwined, definitely. So design has many, many, many different forms. I have a very fun role right now, which is that I'm a jury member on the Danish Design Award. And so I'm surrounded by all these other designers. And sometimes I know nothing about what they're doing, right? Yet we're all designers. And the whole thing is that there's so many different types of design. So you might need product design. You might need, you know, industrial design. How does it look? How does it feel? How does it function? What I specialize in is interaction design. So I look at how people interact with technology, how it fits into their daily routines and into their lives. And there's just so many different ways of looking at design and how design can drive your strategy, your technology development, the form, the function, the approach to market. So yes, definitely entwined.
I know that you have been involved in something you call the women in hardware.
Yes.
So this approach you have, is that specific for women, or would you approach it in another way if you were a man? Or
I think it's a very interesting question. So yeah, I founded this network called Women in Hardware in the Nordics. There's also one in the States. And for me, it's very important to get as many perspectives as possible when we're designing new technologies. And the reason for that is that half the population, generally, given gender inclusivity, is identifying as a woman. So when we develop new products and new services, we should have that perspective in mind, right? And therefore, I think it's really important that we create spaces for women to talk and exchange ideas, because then we can help to develop those technologies in a more well-rounded way.
There is this conference called Design Matters in Copenhagen, which I visited twice, I think. I've never been to a conference with so many female speakers, but when you go to a technology conference, it's mostly men. So do men come from the technology scene and women from the design scene? Or
I think traditionally that's how it's been seen. So traditionally it's been seen that women come with more of the empathy and therefore they're in design, and men come with more of the, you know, hard skills and therefore they're in technology. But that's a very, very stereotypical view of how things are. And that is not only changing right now, but historically has changed. So back when we started with programming and stuff like that, it was often women who were the programmers. There was all these women computers, right? That's what launched rockets. And at some point, someone figured out that it was a very analytical position and they decided to make it a male position. And so we got male programmers. But some of the first programmers en masse were women, right? So I think it's very...
They were actually called computers because they were doing a lot of calculations.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of fascinating history about that, about, you know, the first ones at, oh, what was that lab called? I can't remember now. But an observatory. And, you know, we have so much conditioning and so much perspective that has been set in such a way. And now we have the opportunity to expand that perspective, to expand the narrative of technology. So one of the things that I'm doing is with my friend Maiken Aagaard, we're doing a blog on Ingenieuren called Greater Spaces. And then we're actually interviewing women who are doing incredible things in technology, in all different types of technology, whether they're working with sound or whether they're working with making new circuit boards, or whether they're working with artistic explorations, or whether they're selling kits to people to make hardware, all sorts of different things, because we're trying to make sure that their perspective and their voices are heard and that they're present in these discussions.
When we talked about doing this interview, you told me that you would be, told me about a woman you would like to be when you sort of grow up.
Yeah.
An MIT professor called Neri Oxman. And you, you made me a link for an article, and it starts off like this. To spend an afternoon with Neri Oxman is to find yourself on some sort of acid trip. Is that the way you would like to see yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to say that to spend a day with Vanessa is like that, because...
Like being on an acid trip.
Like being on an acid trip, exploring futures you never thought possible, exploring technologies you've never heard of, finding out what your purpose is and where you're going. And I mean, maybe that's over-promising. I'm not sure I can do that all in a day. But, you know, we used to have, or there are rumors that back in the day in Silicon Valley, that people would do acid to find out the new innovations, right? To come up with these new incredible things that were happening back in, I guess, the 60s or 70s. And I really would love to be the facilitator of that, right? Not of acid trips, let's be clear, but of innovation trips, right? So that I can take companies on a journey of looking at things they've never looked at before, looking to art, looking towards the maker and hacker scene, looking to academia, and bringing that together with industry so that we can create products that matter to people. We should look at social constructs in a new light. How could we potentially imagine people might interact? I mean, none of us predicted, except for maybe Bill Gates, 2020 and the pandemic. And here we are, and we're figuring out how to have conversations with people while wearing masks, standing 2 meters apart, right? So that is an unexpected future for the majority of us, and we're coping with it. We're figuring it out, right? And I think we could expand our minds thinking about emerging technologies, thinking about emerging ways of living. Maybe we're underwater, right? I just taught a course on tangible user interfaces where one of the students explored speculative design, and they did a prototype for 200 years in the future where we're living underwater, right? So I think it's just about expanding our idea of what is now versus what is the expected future.
I'm also thinking, if you look at the post-corona time age, so to speak, it's probably going to be more virtual. And if you become more virtual, if you live in a virtual world, I mean, you won't necessarily be gender specific anymore, because it's easier to become fluid in gender when you're in a virtual world.
It is easier to become more fluid in gender in a virtual world, but I would hope that in our physical world, it's also to become easier to become more fluid in gender, that we become more accepting of non-binary ways of being, and that we create clothing and experiences and restrooms and expectations that are more gender inclusive in that way. It's definitely easier to do a lot of things virtually, but for me, it's really important that we look at the world we inhabit, because there's a lot of different philosophies on how to see the world and how our reality is made up. And at least one of them deals with how our everyday objects create our perception of the world, right? So the chairs we're sitting on or not sitting on and the tables we're at, that is making up our reality. That is making up our understanding of the world, right? And if we move to a fully virtual perspective, that's fine. And then we get into this whole, are we just a brain in a vat conversation, which is great. I'm personally just fascinated by the tangible. I'm fascinated by the human body and what it's capable of. I'm especially interested these days in hormones and the effect that they have on our lives. And I'm really interested in how technology can facilitate our understanding of that and act as a catalyst for future developments.
And then we're moving into the Neri Oxman territory when we talk,
yes,
about synthetic biology and how you can actually use biology to design different people. or objects.
And experiences. And I think one of the fascinating things about her work in her lab is that she works in a very interdisciplinary way, right? So she has a biologist and she has a person who works with molecular structures, and she has an engineer and she has a mechanical engineer, and you know, somehow they all play together and create really incredible things. And that's very much what I'm interested in doing with Kintsugi design, is working in this interdisciplinary way, because that's how I've always worked, right? I've always played with a lot of people in from different sandboxes and been making very weird sandcastles in the middle. And I'm hoping that those sandcastles can help us to disrupt our idea of what the future can be.
Now you used the word disrupt.
I did. It happened.
So a 50-year future of Vanessa on acid would be like ambient technology and gender fluidity.
That's one of them, for sure. I think it's people who are focusing on empathy first and trying to be compassionate and be considerate, and developing a world where we come first thinking of how we can make better relations with other people, with other species, with the planet, and second, how we can, you know, create new structures, new businesses, new ways of making money, if money even exists in 50 years.
I think we have to stop there. Ja, hvis du bliver nysgerrig, så kan du som sagt finde Vanessa Carpenters blog på ingeniøren.dk. Og når vi nu snakker om Ingeniøren, så har vi sammen også modtaget et podkort fra deres podcast Transformator.
Indsejlingen til Danmarks mange havne har det mere sandt. Det må man afsted med prammer. Sådan har det altid været. Problemet er blot nu at sejle ulammet lige ud af havlammet, lige ud af havne i naturbeskyttelsesområder, hvor det slår alt med myndighedernes velsignet. Alt hvad du gør ved din mobil, bliver logget for politiet til gæld for politiselskaberne gør det. Ikke bare med myndighederne, ikke bare med myndighederne, men lige frem på opfordring fra de danske myndigheder. Og nede i Tyskland, og nede i Tyskland, en gigafabrik, en gigafabrik, og det tyske bilfabrik, der er ved at lukke fabrikker, der er ved at lukke fabrikker. Hør hvordan man bygger os fabrikker, 10.000 ansatte, og går i gang med at lave biler, og går i gang med at lave biler, bygget fabrikker, bygget færdig. I denne uges transformator, skal vi altså forbi danske kyster, forbi danske kysterovervågning, og gigafabrikker. Men vi skal også høre svaret på, hvordan man skal høre svaret på, hvordan man skal høre svaret på, hvordan man skal høre svaret på, hvordan man
skal. Du kan altid finde os på tektopia.dk. Du kan skrive til mig på henrik@tektopia.dk. Følg os på Twitter på @tektopia.dk. Og så kan du deltage i diskussionen om teknologi i vores Facebook-gruppe, den hedder Tektopia Backstage, og der er du altid velkommen til at komme ind og være med til at diskutere eller uploade interessante historier, som du har fundet om teknologi, eller måske mulige fremtider. Det kan man jo aldrig vide. Tilbage er der kun at sige på genhør, og må din krystalkugle være med dig. Tektopia. Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi, udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Ugeavisen Ingeniøren, med støtte fra Innovation Center Danmark, Messecenter Herning og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia. Tektopia.